Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm stand-up comedian James Mullinger and the co-founder of Edit Magazine. This is Mullinger Meets Canadians, the podcast where we meet Canadians who are making waves on the world stage. In this episode, I'm meeting one of Canada's most versatile performers and the undisputed king of Canadian podcasting, Jonathan Tollens. The actor, director, producer, writer, podcast host, musician, and television personality began his career at 15 when he was cast as the host of the hit youth show Street Sense. Just 7 years later, he created, wrote, co-produced, and hosted Jonovision, a wildly successful teen talk show that aired for 5 years and received 7 prestigious Gemini Awards. But he's perhaps best known for his ingenious 10-year run with the Trailer Park Boys playing J-Rock, and more recently for his role as Mr. Chile, the vice principal in Mr. D. He's also played roles in Jason Priestley's hit show Call Me Fitz, Degrassi The Next Generation, Game On, and he wrote 7 episodes for the global comedy sensation that is Letterkenny. His success has also translated into the podcast world. He and Jeremy Taggart created Taggart and Torrens, a podcast that has been downloaded more than 4 million times and received a Canadian Comedy Award for Best Audio Program in 2018. Its success has also led to a best-selling book and album. It's January 2021. We are a year into the global pandemic, and normally right now, Jonathan and I would be on the road, performing somewhere in the world. Instead, we are both on our makeshift stages in our DIY studios at home. He in rural Nova Scotia, me in rural New Brunswick. Let's do this. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm well, how are you?
I'm very good indeed. This is very exciting. I am very honored to be talking with you.
The pleasure is entirely mine. I have so many questions for you, but I'll wait to turn the tables on you until I've gotten my feet wet with a few of your questions.
Okay. Yes, it's supposed to be me asking you questions, but I am amenable to everything. It's funny, we started this podcast, as a lot of podcasts did, during the early days of lockdown. And it was interesting because we kind of felt, oh, we shouldn't talk too much about COVID or lockdowns because that's going to not be a thing anymore. But here we are a year later and it's still a thing. So I have to start by asking, how are you coping and how have you been evolving during this time?
Well, I think like everyone, I feel like the roadrunner a little bit, runs off the cliff and his legs are still moving with no ground underneath him. I do a lot of corporate hosting in the States. So typically this Q1, which is kind of January to April, I would be on the road pretty hard, mostly in Vegas. In fact, last February, I was there 3 weeks in a row and kind of come home on the red eye Thursday night and leave again Sunday morning. So the first thing is I'm around more and I love that. I've in fact been spoiled and low-key dreading when the world opens again and I have to leave my family. I found my circle has gotten so small, in fact, that if I go to Truro for groceries, which is about 5 minutes away, I have this internal clock ticking and thinking, oh, I'd best get home.
Yes.
The work from home aspect of it, as I'm sure has been your experience too, I had to kind of figure out our house is pretty open. So for the first while, if I was working, people felt the need to be sequestered in rooms as far away as possible. I actually bought a shed and put it in my backyard and got its own dedicated internet line, which, as you know, in rural Canada is enough of a challenge. So once I kind of cracked that nut, it's been great.
Yeah, it's an incredible thing. I mean, who could have predicted that this would ever be possible? Because I mean, doing the job that we do, it naturally means traditionally, being away, being on the road. And there are, and of course, you know, there's plenty of people that will say that it's not the same, and of course it's very different. But when you are people like you and I, who, as much as we love our jobs, we also love our families and we love being at home, this is in some ways a very bizarre and strange gift.
It is. And all the advice I've ever gotten about parenting has to do with how fast it goes by. And this was really a chance to slow it down. There's also, in this part of Canada, we're kind of sheepish and self-deprecating by nature, as you know. And I haven't figured out what the word is for the sheepishness I feel around having enjoyed this time so much. But I know that hasn't been everyone's experience, but we loved homeschooling the girls. We did FaceTime calls with their grandparents who taught subjects that they knew. Their aunts taught subjects over FaceTime. It was kind of a really nice bonding experience for us. And again, I'm optimistic to a fault. And I know, you know, if you have twin two-year-old boys, that's probably not the case for you. But I have really enjoyed it. The one kind of strange thing that I know you know better than most is, doing these corporate gigs, a lot of it is comedy based, and I'll walk in the house, which is a luxury, and my wife will say, "How did it go?" And I'll say, "I have no idea." Like, you're kind of putting jokes out into the ether. And I don't know if it's your instinct too, when you don't get the laughter back, your instinct is to just bail and pick up the pace. Like, this isn't landing for whatever reason. So it took me a little bit to get comfortable enough with the material and think, well, I assume people are laughing the same as they would in a live environment, so I just have to trust.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny, and you kind of realize one of the selling points, actually, of these virtual gigs is that in the space of an hour, the audience are getting probably double the number of jokes, because traditionally in a live environment, a laugh can last 15, 20 seconds, but you never leave 15, 20 seconds in a virtual gig.
Oh, that's true.
You leave about five. So you're packing in so much more material. So it's double the number of laughs, and they don't have to leave their homes.
Exactly.
The dream.
I had, like, from an economic standpoint, in the early days, I was so happy to have the opportunity to work from home. I kind of cut my rate. Like, I'm just happy to have the gig. I'm going to, it's a half a day rate because I'm not away from home, and I'm just happy to do it. I don't know if the economics of it work quite as well as the geography does. We will see.
Yeah, I mean, I found that even though I was cutting my rate dramatically, I was clearly, even though the income was down, the expenses were way down, because I wasn't eating sushi three times a day like I do when I'm on the road, because I'm miserable and need to be cheered up. I'm not drinking half the night. So whatever was kind of being reduced from the fee was also being massively taken away out of the expense budget.
Okay, the history books will show that you were way ahead of the curve on this. But I read an interesting thread recently about the kind of long-term ripples in the wake of COVID, and it had to do with the work-from-home experience and how employers are worried that their employees will not generate productivity at the same level if they're not in the office. This thread suggested otherwise, that people will, in fact, work more because the lines are so blurred between when work is finished and when it starts. You'll probably pick up your phone and send emails all night, for example. But the thing that's different is, first of all, you can do it from anywhere, like St. John. Secondly, you can go for a jog in the middle of the morning if you feel like it. Instead of appearing busy in your cubicle, you're actually being more productive and getting things done. But the nice side effect of this is that we will return to being more community oriented, because work is no longer a social outlet in the traditional sense. We will want to be joining clubs and joining sports teams and doing things like that. Is that what drove you to go to St. John?
Good question. And yes, I mean, the simple answer is yes, absolutely. I mean, the thing that drove me here was quality of life. It was, I'd spent 13 years working in an office in London where that was the perfect example of an unproductive office environment where people are kind of bowling in at 10 p.m. You come in and then it's like, right, I'll go and get my breakfast now. And it was a company that was very adamant that you had to be in there. It was a creative environment. It was a magazine environment where even if you had a 3,000-word feature to write by 5 p.m. that day, they didn't want you doing it at home. It's you have to come in the office. And of course, you would come in the office, and of course, it wouldn't get done because there are dozens of distractions happening all of the time. And of course, I mean, interestingly, this same magazine right now, back in London, they've been in lockdown for close to a year. Everyone's working right from home. Everything's working perfectly well. So, I mean, to your point, I feel like, and especially now being here where I got here for all of those reasons, for to be in a place with a sense of community, to give my children an upbringing surrounded with water and, you know, to know our neighbors' names and all of those things. When I moved here, I obviously didn't know that I was going to be able to continue a creative field here. I mean, that's how much I wanted this lifestyle, was I thought I was coming here to give it all up. So it was a surprise to be able to do it full stop. But suddenly now to be in a situation where I can do, you know, 4 corporate gigs in a day for a company in Alberta and London and, you know, wherever else, which, of course, wouldn't have been possible before because of geography. It's bizarre. And like you said, I mean, it does, you know, there's no getting around the fact that you know, this period is terrible and there's people suffering. And of course, I mean, I didn't always feel this way. In March, when lockdown happened, there was a couple of weeks and months of absolute fear and terror. And are we going to have to, you know, downsize? What are we going to do? Are we going to have to move back to England, live with my parents? All of those fears that I think everyone had. But I also do think it's important to acknowledge, as we have been just now, that there are some positives to this environment, to this situation, including, of course, yeah, the effect on the environment as well as people's health and mental health.
Well, that's the thing. And to return to this thread for a moment, it suggested that people in big cities could save 24 days a year in commuting time. And I always say we pay so much attention to how we spend our money, but we don't give the same critical thought to how we spend our time. Imagine what you would do if you were gifted 24 extra days in a year. And when people say, oh, that must be hard in Lower Onslow, Nova Scotia, to work in the entertainment business, the truth is, in theory, the cost of living is such that I can coast for longer if I ever had to. Trailer Park Boys was the first example for me of it doesn't matter where it's made or how it looks. If it's funny, it will find an audience and it will resonate and it will travel. And it's inconceivable that show is now 20 years old and finding new life yet again on Netflix with teenage boys all over the world. It started on before you were here, a network called Showcase that no one had ever heard of. So that was a great lesson to me, that if it's good, you can make it anywhere.
Right. And do you remember that kind of early stage of Trailer Park Boys when it was kind of being evolved, and when was the moment that you kind of realized that it was going to resonate with people? Because it almost seems incredible now that it happened, especially then.
It continues to be incredible that it happened, and we thought that it felt funny to us, but it also felt so insular and like such a unique patois to this group of friends who grew up in this tiny geographical radius. And like to the point where we thought, I don't know if people in New Glasgow will get it because it's so kind of Dartmouth. So then it landed with a thud. Critics were confounded by this thing. It was before the mockumentary device was so widely used and accepted. Some people thought it was a documentary. It obviously, one of its most important characters was its aesthetic, which was, low rent and handicap. And in fact, one of the struggles over the years as technology got better was that the show couldn't look as bad as it was supposed to. It was one of the missteps of the first movie. It was shot on 35mm and big, gorgeous shots of the sky and stuff. It kind of lost its vibe. And in making the show, more stuff, more thought goes into, for example, the premise. If the guys are breaking into a bank, it's a better shot to have the camera inside the bank and have them climb in the window and step over the camera. But if you're keeping the device, the camera should, in fact, be following them into the bank. More like we think about that stuff more than you would ever imagine. Alas, I can't even remember what the original question was. I just got fired up about the aesthetic. Oh, yeah. It's all
it's interesting,
couldn't imagine it would travel.
Yeah, and as you say, I mean, it's still resonating now with a new audience. I mean, I have people, you know, people back in England who know nothing about Canada saying to me, oh, you're from the region where Trailer Park Boys was made. I mean, and as you say, I mean, it's an incredible thing that that, like all great comedy, you've basically got to create it in a way that that you think it is funny, and then it will find its audience. If you try and do it in focus group style and go, what, we'll reach the widest audience possible, it just doesn't work.
I will share with you an anecdote about how the one thing about Trailer Park Boys, and indeed all great comedies that I've been lucky enough to work on, Letterkenny is another example. Jared Kiso knows the show. He knows the voice. He knows the characters. And you can pitch a joke and he'll say, that's a great joke. It's not our show. In comedy, right, it has to be one person's point of view. Obviously, that's easier to execute as a stand-up in some ways. But in a collaborative environment, you want people to feel included and like they can contribute ideas and the best idea wins. But also, ultimately, it has to be one person's vision. So for a corporate gig I was doing recently, for reasons I won't bore you, the theme had the word B in it. So I was in a B costume. And after interviewing the CEO about the plans for the year, the kind of conclusion was, okay, so what you're saying is, don't worry, be happy. And the karaoke track kicks in, and in a B costume, I sing, don't worry, be happy. Pretty simple premise. But when
In your shed.
In my shed, in my backyard.
Yes,
like
I love
with
it.
A smiling like a husky. Thank you very invoice. Like, I'm just so happy to be at the table and be able to walk into my back door. Like, that's a huge win in our business. If you're making a living in the arts, you're already in the top 5% of people.
Absolutely.
But this corporate stuff I struggled with a little bit at first, as I'm sure you did. Alas, this don't worry, be happy was put to the brain trust. And it was kind of felt, well, you know what? People are worried, though. So should we say worry? Because we don't want to underline the fact that people are worried. So it became stay focused, be happy, which is sort of good, but it's not really what we meant. And it kind of entirely changes the idea. And then there was some discussion about whether telling people to be happy was toxic positivity. And whether that's what you want to put out. So suddenly I'm in a bee costume singing like happy birthday or oh Canada. Like it had, it's a single entendre. It has nothing to do with a bee. But I guess that underlines the idea of an idea being someone's vision. And Trailer Park Boys was always Mike Clattenburg's vision. And he, like Jared, was very quick to say, that's great. This is not, this works, this doesn't. And Mike's genius was we chewed a scene with Randy and Ricky. They're bickering and it's funny. And Mike would say, let's try it again. But Randy has a bag of sour cream and onion chips. And Ricky, you're trying to get them from him during the same scene. And that would just elevate it from like hilarious to preposterous. And I think that was its magic.
Yeah, that's so true. And it's interesting. I think you touched upon something fascinating there about the corporate environment of jokes being workshopped is that one of the things that, I mean, certainly as a virtual comedian, but certainly as a corporate comedian, full stop, and definitely as any type of performer doing what we do based out of any small place, but particularly the Maritimes, is that a lot of the time, probably more than almost anyone in a bigger city, when we're doing our thing, our performing, our entertaining, our comedy work, the majority of the time we are dealing with people who don't work in comedy or indeed entertainment at all. So you almost have to speak this different language. When you're in a writer's room or collaborating with, you know, with Jerry D.
Right, there's a shorthand.
There's a shorthand and nothing needs to be. And yet more so than almost any performer in LA or New York or London, the majority of the time you or I are basically collaborating with people who have never once told a joke or written a joke professionally in their lives, but we're having to give them equal voice. How do you kind of balance that with your comedic sensibility?
Well, I thought a lot about it in the early going because it's daunting. It's a daunting prospect. I did a Domino's meeting for 9,000 general managers and franchisees from 79 countries, a third of whom English isn't their first language. So I kind of embraced the challenge of trying to tap into what does this group of people with different geographical, socioeconomic, ethical, religious backgrounds. What is the common denominator for what is funny? And I'd be curious to hear your answer to this. My conclusion ultimately is silly. Silly is something that the world needs more of. Sight gags are something that are pretty bomb-proof and pretty universal. What I had to figure out in this context was there's a Mark L. Wahlberg, not Marky Mark the actor, but Mark L. Wahlberg hosts Antiques Roadshow and Temptation Island. We had the same manager when I lived in LA, and he does a lot of this corporate hosting stuff. He's very high energy. He's the guy who's like, In a room full of 5,000 people, hands on the buzzers. Oh, what do you guys think? Oh, hands up, everybody. Oh, clap if you think Dennis has it right. Oh, who thinks Amanda does? It's not my energy. So I had to find out what I could bring to it. And I feel like I use a lot of sketch characters. I do a lot of kind of between two ferns style uncomfortable interviews. I do a lot of re-lyricing of songs. For example, I worked with a company called Relipsa and performed Total Relipsa the Heart. I worked with a company that does gout, gout medication. I sang Let It Gout. You know, like it's pretty low hanging fruit and it's a 1-inch putt, but I find that the bar is refreshingly accessible. And more often than not, if they are ingesting serious information, and a lot of times it's a cancer medication or they're doing real serious important work and it's a lot to ingest. If the very sight of me means they can exhale for a moment, not pay attention, tune out, or kind of laugh to recharge the batteries, that does fulfill a useful function in the space of a 4-day meeting. So I've kind of embraced the challenge and now I love it.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, it's a unique skill set that almost goes against the idea, the kind of comedy club mindset of, you know, you've got to push the audience, you've got to push them, you've got to challenge them. And it's like, no, they are being challenged. Life challenges them. What we need to do is entertain them, make them laugh, and essentially by any means possible. And that isn't, you know, I mean, it's one of those things that people always say to me, you know, with corporate gigs, do you try and push it? And it's like, well, I mean, obviously push it if I'm pushing it to be as funny as it can, but I'm never trying to do anything that would make anyone uncomfortable, because that's not why I'm there or why they're there.
Well, that's, I've learned it's a subtle distinction, but the difference between a host and a comedian is a very important one. I see my role as a host. I like a dinner party. I want people to leave having had a nice time. No one's feelings are hurt. And I learned quite quickly, probably the hard way, that you figure out where the line is and don't cross it. You can dance close to it, and that's when it's a thrill for people. But you can undo a lot of goodwill in one poorly timed quip. And I know as a stand-up working the club circuit, you're probably, your reflex instinct is to go for the joke and go for the jugular. This is not that. And especially I find if I take 5 or 6 shots at myself out of the gate, then I've kind of earned the opportunity to take some gentle nerf pokes at people. But if you come out like swinging at the CEO in the front row, people are like, what are you doing? You're a guest.
That's it.
You haven't earned that.
Yeah. It's so true. I mean, I mentioned to you recently that I saw the CBC film that you did for Canada 150, and I absolutely loved it on so many levels.
Thank you. But,
I mean, the fact that it was both, you know, well, it was really, really beautiful, and I sat and watched it with my kids. And again, it's one of those wonderful things that I love with any form of comedy entertainment is when my 7-year-old is laughing as hard as my mother-in-law. You know, we're all three generations are enjoying it just as much. And I love the fact that it was you know, historically correct, but also the celebration of the country, but also most importantly, when you are interviewing the people, it's a very, very finite line between you're being funny and you're getting laughs out of them, but you're also being respectful. And how did you learn that kind of skill set?
People underestimate how exhausting non-verbal reinforcement is, right? Doing streeters right. is one of the most challenging aspects of this business, especially in this part of the world where people are kind of retiring and shy just by nature. Like, what's your favorite ice cream? Oh, I don't know. I have to think about that. So the nonverbal, like, yeah, I couldn't nodding, possibly say. Smiling, okay. You're doing great. Yeah, I couldn't possibly say in case I, yeah, I couldn't yeah. say rum and raisin in case I offended Big Strawberry.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and who really wants to hear what I have to say
yeah,
anyway?
Exactly. Well, it's a part of the world where not too bad is the standard answer to how are you today, because anything more would be showing off, right?
Yes.
To say, like, I'm doing great. That's like, whoa, easy yeah, there, big guy. No need to show off.
So
I think it's the energy that goes into the nonverbal stuff that kind of makes, you're creating a safe space where people feel like they can talk. And the other aspect of that really works is silence. And it's the same right. technique you use as an interviewer. If people think the laws of social grace that apply to conversation apply to an interview, but if I ask you a question and you give an answer and I don't jump in right away, people are wired to think, oh dear, I haven't delivered. What else could I say? And that's often when you get the good stuff.
Very true. But again, there's a unique skill set to that as well, where you do leave the pause and then you turn to the camera and you arch an eyebrow. But that facial expression is very distinct in that it can't look like you are being rude about them. The facial expression might be quizzical, it might be confused, but it's a unique moment. And again, this is one of the things that you nailed so well in that particular film, was that, you know, at no point does it look like you are being mean about the person.
Well, and you can do that, but the second you do that, you're in that category of, oh, okay, this guy thinks he's better than everyone. Got it. That's his right. kind of vantage point. And it's just not what I really want to put out there right. at this time. I'd rather, my friend worked at Swiss Chalet. And as a teenager, when he was being trained, they said, when you're offering people dessert, say, would you like some pecan pie? And while you're saying that, smile and nod at them. So they will somehow just be lured into, you know what? Suddenly I find myself wanting pie. Thank you. And it's the same sort of muscle reflex when you're doing streeters.
Yeah, that's so true. We were talking earlier about the creation of Trailer Park Boys, but can you tell me a bit about the creation of your character J-Rock and how that evolved and, you know, how it was that you managed to kind of embody him so well and just, you know, I mean, become him?
Well, I went to school with those guys. I went to school with a lot of J-Rocks, and Mike Clattenburg grew up in Cole Harbor and went to Cole Harbor High, and there were a lot of kind of J-Rock characters there. We were both exposed to a lot of people from the Black community in Nova Scotia who just have an inherent sense of humor that is faster and funny. It's like a friend of mine was doing stand-up in Newfoundland, and the club closed over there, and he said it's probably because the hecklers were a million times funnier than anyone on stage, just naturally. So the way Newfoundlanders are funny. These guys that we went to school with were so funny. And Clattenburg worked at Sobeys in Cole Harbor with this guy named Arnold, who was this tall, skinny guy with an attitude. And the manager would come over and say, Arnold, you need to wash the lettuce. And then he'd walk away. And Mike would say, Arnold, aren't you going to do it? And he'd say, he ain't beating me. Which meant if it came down to a physical fist fight, the manager couldn't make Arnold wash the lettuce. And that stuff was somehow so funny to us that when we started working at CBC in Halifax, we would talk like that on the page system throughout the billing. Like, hey, Mike, you know what I'm saying? Meet me on the van, dog. Like echoing through the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation as people were trying to put together the supper hour news and things like that. So it always right. made us laugh. He went to high school with Rob and JP, the guys that play Ricky and Julian. And they were living on Prince Edward Island, long, cold winters. They started making little videos to make each other laugh and sending them to Mike. So he had the idea of doing this show, and he said, you should play that character on the series. But I was in a crazy car accident that year and was still walking with a cane. So I called Mike and said, you know what? I don't know if I'm going to be ready to play the character. I'm still walking with a cane, broke my femur really badly. And he was like, just rock it. So in season one of Trailer Park Boys, J-Rock has a cane. It's never explained. It's just sort of baked into the character. And again, that's the genius of Mike. Like, just rock it. It's good advice for life.
Yeah, totally. And again, it's one of those things, but him having that cane actually makes perfect sense for the character.
Yeah, it looks like a great choice. No one would ever know. When yes, in fact, it was just an accident.
And obviously, I mean, you got into entertainment very, very young. Did you realize at that point, like, I mean, I guess it's interesting because one of the things that I get asked a lot when I do talks in the Maritimes at schools and so forth is, you know, people thinking that they have to move away in order to get a job in entertainment or indeed any creative field. And one of the things I'm always trying to explain to people is that here, in actual fact, the playing field is more level because there isn't a kind of a necessarily a well-worn path that you have to follow. You can forge your own. You can create your own trail in the woods here and do whatever you want. But you seem to realize that very early on. How was that?
Well, in a cliche as old as time, it took going away to realize how good I had it here. I started on Street Sense at 15. And as a TV school, it was original characters every week. It was celebrity impressions every week. It was learning to hit a mark and find the light and be a host as myself on camera. It was kind of the Swiss Army knife of TV experiences. The interesting thing is, and it took me a while to figure out when I got down there, is when I turned 30, I'd been on CBC for 15 years, and out of self-imposed exile and adventure, I went to America just to see. And they like to be able to categorize you there. Are you a host, or are you a comedian, or are you a sitcom actor, or are you a dramatic actor? And the truth is, I'd kind of done a little bit of all of those things, but they don't really roll like that. You're one or you're the other. And Canada has allowed me to be reimagined. Like, I had a teen talk show called Jonovision, and after that I was J-Rock on Trailer Park Boys, and after that I was the guy on Mr. D. You can kind of do a page turn here, and people are open-minded enough, I guess, to embrace that, whereas you can't really do that in the States. So it's been partially because I want to move on before the audience does or before I'm kind of bored with a role. But I think the nice upside of that is that it's allowed me to have a few different chapters, and I'd rather have a career than one role. Plus, I couldn't be J-Rock for a living. It's 6 weeks of work in the summer. It's not enough money. It would be like painting with one color on your palette.
It's so true. I mean, but what do you think it is about Canada and specifically, I mean, Atlantic Canada, that doesn't pigeonhole people? Because, I mean, it's definitely the case in a creative field, like you say, like, you know, in London, I was either a stand-up or something else. I couldn't be more than one thing. And yet here you can be, you know, you can be a magazine editor and a stand-up, and no one questions that those two things might seem odd. And but that also does transcend all jobs and in employments. I mean, my first week here, I got pulled over by a cop for speeding in a school zone because I hadn't heard of
it. I thought you were going to say for driving on the left.
I didn't realize.
Speaking of cliches, I was hoping that was why.
Yeah, I should have done that just before. And I'd literally never, because in England we don't have school zones, because we figure if the kids are safely in school, why do we need to be all going backwards?
See, that makes sense.
But I got pulled over, and the cop, I met the cop anyway that weekend. I was doing a stand-up set at a wedding, and I realized they recognized the DJ, and they said, oh, he's one of the best wedding DJs in New Brunswick. Anyway, and I couldn't figure out where I recognized him from, and it was the cop.
No.
And yeah, and no one would ever question that, yes, he's a cop, but he's also one of the best wedding DJs. That wouldn't be considered strange here, whereas in England it's like, well, no, you can't do both. What do you think it is about this region that lets people? And again, I mean, I've come across many examples
hyphenates
like this, where Yeah, and always like totally disparate jobs. Like, you know, the sales manager at Lexus also manages one of the most kind of shady bars.
Right.
Like, you know, two completely disparate jobs, and no one questions it. And I mean, part of it, I guess, is the Atlantic Canadian attitude of whatever it takes, do whatever it takes, like do what you got to do to make a living. But
I think
it
that
really
is
definitely
it. And
feels freeing.
In a small town, I suppose there wouldn't be a wedding DJ if that cop didn't step up to also do that. All right. I can say is it's sort of how I'm wired. I don't know if it was bred into me because I live here or that's just who I am. But I will tell you, this past year especially, I was so happy that I do more than one thing for a living because the bottom dropped out of TV in a way I never would. This past year was the first year in 30 years that the bulk of my income didn't come from performing on television. Right. I've had a steady presence on television for 30 years. And this year I wrote a Letterkenny, and I have a trailer business as a side hustle, and my trailers were rented on a film. So technically that counts as income from film and TV. But
exactly.
But the bulk of my income did not come from that. It came from flipping houses and you know, some other real estate holdings and things that I'm so thankful that I came up with some kind of steady sources of income because I could never have imagined this would fluctuate the way it did. So I'm thankful for that entrepreneurial spirit for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely a wonderful thing. I mean, at what point did you realize that, obviously, you know, it was kind of March, April when everything, you know, that us kind of fell out of everything. At what point did virtual begin to become something that you were willing to consider? And then at what point did you kind of start to embrace it?
Well, I found the first wave, probably both of COVID and of things going virtual. People had a much higher tolerance for cats showing up on your desk and half-eaten sandwiches in the frame and graphics made of crayons. But yeah. I think it was about midsummer where people started to realize that, okay, this isn't funny. It should still look and feel like a show. And even if we're putting it on in Grampy's barn, it still has to be the best anyone can do. So from a corporate standpoint, they started to use control rooms. And again, I was so thankful for this Swiss Army knife background that I have because I've done a lot of live TV broadcasting, and this is very much the same. I'm getting cues. I'm getting countdown clocks. I have to throw it to a guest. I have to do emotional page turns from I'm being silly to now here's a cancer patient. Like, those are about the most abrupt 180s you can do tonally. But again, I think it's because I've been a host, not just a comedian. So I have those kind of tools in my kit. And so it was really a realization of, oh, I have a good opportunity here to carve out a niche for myself because there aren't a lot of people. I always say my biggest virtue is that I can do a little bit of a lot of things. It's like the cocktail circuit people who have kind of read the headlines, but they haven't read the whole article. Like, I can sort of speak to many different facets of how a show like this goes, but I can't really do a deep dive on any. There are better sketch performers than me. There are better hosts than me, certainly. I usually default to a kind of sketch host character, and it usually starts with my voice. When I start talking like that, you know, I'm not really being me. Because I think in my core, I'm probably a sketch performer. But yeah, it was about the summer when I was like, okay, it's time to get a shed. The shed hit the fans.
Yeah. Yeah, the shed is very smart because I mean I'm still having to do that thing of like, right, if it's a no holds barred virtual gig, it's like, okay, the kids need to be upstairs in a soundproof room. I never anticipated they would ever be listening in on anything other than a clean show. And then other times it's like having to remove them from the house. But one of the things that I find you mentioned there about how that point at which it went from, you know, you would get booked for a virtual gig and people would be like, right, I need to download Zoom. And then suddenly 2 months later, it's we're bringing in a tech team in Toronto who are going to be handling the tech side of things. And I mean, obviously, as you say, it was companies that realized very quickly that these things had to look and feel professional. I guess what I'm gearing up to here is do you see a future in virtual events and virtual shows even after the whole world has been vaccinated?
Well, I think there are competing forces at work. If you look at the last gig I had in March that was canceled at the last minute, they had 2,500 attendees flying into Vegas and staying for 6 nights at the Aria Hotel. They had to feed everyone chicken breasts. They had to, I think on the Thursday night, they typically rent a nightclub for their people to have an end of the night party. It's $400,000. That's a lot of dough. So for the companies to go virtual is great. They save a lot. I'll be curious to see what happens with like real estate, because I'm starting to hear of some companies that are seeing people working from home for the next 2 years. So they're selling their office buildings. Why wouldn't they?
Right.
But the other side of that is for the attendees, the human connection and the late night sitting at the hotel bar and the chance to compare notes and exchange best practices and things like that. Like, hopefully human connection will still be something that motivates us. And I guess that's why, again, returning to this thread, it was suggesting that we'll want to play darts more and pick up soccer games and find ways to be together if it's not going to be at the office. And that's kind of a nice notion.
Yeah. No, it's so true. And I think that's where I see it going as well, that hopefully those things do come back. But equally, that there's a balance, because interestingly, one of the bits of feedback that I've had from virtual shows, and certainly in summer last year, when you know what it's like when you get onto a particular circuit. Like, I mean, I know, you know, in normal times I would kind of do one like nurses convention gig, and then suddenly I'd have 12 bookings for different nursing things, and you know, you end up on this kind of particular industry. And the last summer it was teachers and school boards, and one of the main messages I would get after the gigs would be from people who would say that prior to this they would always miss, they would never go on the excursions or wellness events or, you know, office outings, either because they're shy or financial reasons, maybe they care for someone at home, and that these virtual gigs, it was the first time they'd ever seen live comedy, and essentially, I mean, it's live and it's happening in the moment, but also that it was the first time they'd felt included, because for whatever reason they don't like going to pubs, they don't like going to theatres, and suddenly now they felt like they were part of a group. Yeah, and that really hit home, because I would never have considered that, but it kind of made sense.
It does. I mean, I think people are trying the very best they can to the point where I know even in my own life, I'm so busy being optimistic and up for it and hashtag pivoting and rallying and finding new ways to do my old job. I think there's got to be a word for the sentiment that you're allowing yourself to feel a bit disappointed. I'm like I said, so optimistic by nature, and are you kidding? This is great. In fact, it's better. Like that's my default, is to find the bright side. But for example, we had a family trip planned to Hawaii in March because I had a gig in San Francisco. I know in the bigger picture, so many people have it worse than me having to cancel a trip to Hawaii. I know that people have lost loved ones and it's scary, and people have lost their jobs and don't know how they're going to pay their rent. And like, there are much bigger fish to fry. And at the same time, I think it's okay to allow yourself a micro disappointment that your plans had to change. I know, again, I can't preface it enough by saying I know a lot of people will never get to go to Hawaii, and it's not lost on me what a privilege and trip of a lifetime that would be. But But I think it would be weird if deep down I didn't allow myself even a moment of, oh, man. Right? What is that called in the valley between devastation and unfailing optimism? I think it's not genuine to pretend you're not a little disappointed. I'm sure virtual performing is great, but you would probably rather be crushing it and feeling that roll of live laughs coming back at you.
Of course. And there's probably, there should also be a word for the exhaustion of trying to stay positive about it all of the time. Because as you say, I mean, you know, there are the benefits we've talked about. I'm enjoying being at home more. I'm enjoying being around the family more. But yes, I mean, all of that boils down to, and you put it very beautifully there, all of it comes back to the fact that I'm trying to be positive about a situation that is clearly far from ideal, even though obviously there's, you know, majority of people are far, far worse off and suffering more. There is that kind of innate sadness, which we're all trying to kind of keep at bay all the time. And I wonder at what point there is that kind of tipping point.
Yeah. Like I said to my wife last week, I always enjoy the days best that my mind is tired, my hands are tired, like my brain is tired. I do a little bit of everything in the run of a day. And one of the reasons that I like living in rural Nova Scotia is that I can do that. Today already, I've gone for a walk. I've enjoyed this conversation. I shoveled horse poo in the barn. I feel like I'm at my best when I have that combo. But on our walk the other day, I said out of nowhere, remember New York? As if it doesn't exist anymore, or the option of us going there will never return. And some days when you see tens of thousands of Alabama Clemson Tide fans celebrating on one city block, it feels like we will never return there. But the one thing I know to be true is that the way humans are wired, the rearview mirror has a way of condensing things into, you know, the tiniest little particle. So I know once this is over, it will feel like it was the blink of an eye, but not unlike the weather in this part of the world. I think it's pretty natural that some days it's sunny in the morning and cloudy in the afternoon.
Yeah. And that's that will be a wonderful name for your autobiography.
Exactly. Sunny in the morning, cloudy in the afternoon.
That's absolutely beautiful. On that, and I'll close with this because I felt like it comes back to one of the things that I'm kind of fascinated by most about your career. You know, the fact that thing of having to be, of needing to stay upbeat. Of course, in normal times when you are out and about and on the road and working and having to kind of be not necessarily on, but to kind of convey this happiness. What do you think is different about the nature of Canadian celebrity to kind of being recognizable in any other part of the world?
Well, I guess the most succinct way I can put it is I can't even say the phrase Canadian celebrity without giggling. Like, I think if the subcategory is Canadian celebrities who didn't have to go to the States to get validated, it's a pretty short list. Like Rick Mercer, undoubtedly, Gordon Pinsent, like Alan Doyle is probably on that list. Like people that, you know, most people would recognize a picture of them. It's a pretty short list. And you're on that list. I don't know if I'm on that list.
You're definitely on that list. At the very least, I imagine there's almost any room you can walk in the country where, at the very least, someone in that room is going to go.
There's that guy from that thing.
Yes. And that's celebrity. That is exactly what a celebrity is.
But do you know what? In the same way that the cop was the DJ, I'm going to say conservatively 50% of the time, people will say, oh, I know who you are. Oh, you do? Yeah, you went to camp with my cousin Trina. Like, I'm not that guy. People know that I'm some guy. They just can't always quite put their finger on which guy. And that's just fine. I am extremely social in my work. I'm extremely private and retiring in my real life. That's why I live in the middle of a field with no doorbell. Because a doorbell would greatly decrease our chances of pretending we're not home.
That's beautiful. And that must be a wonderful thing, like when you get stopped in a grocery store and people go, oh, I know you, you're the guy with the trailers. Like yeah, yeah, that, exactly. That's maritime celebrity.
Well, in the country, I'm the guy who's famous for not knowing how to do a single thing for himself because everyone barters, like, tell you what, I'll do your plumbing, you do my electrical. I'll fix your car, you do my roofing. All I have to offer is hosting, and nobody needs that done.
Well, yeah, I mean, right now, but, you know, let's face it, everyone has a kids' party, and you have a bee costume now,
no kidding.
You can turn up and...
I also have a lobster costume. Oh, dear. There's a hashtag pivot I did not see coming. Children's birthday parties.
You have an entire wardrobe costume, wardrobe department in your shed
that is
also now basically it's a venue in every single big city in the world.
Do you know what? If you ask how my work is going, it's not too bad. And that is about the best anyone could say in this unprecedented time.
That is beautiful. Jonathan, thank you so much for your time, insights, and honestly, that was absolutely magical.
I really enjoyed our chat. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you so much. Keep in touch, and let's do this again sometime.
I would love that. Next time, the tables will be turned.
Okay, beautiful. I will take that challenge, and I will bring some of the costumes that I have in my basement. Yes. Happy days. Have a great day, and we'll speak again soon.
You too.
Thank you for listening to Mullinger Meets Canadians. If you like greatness, creativity, being inspired, laughing, or just love Canada as much as I do, then this is the podcast for you. So please do subscribe and review the show now. Be sure to follow Jonathan on Twitter at TorrensJonathan and go to taggartontorrens.ca to subscribe to their awesome podcast. Further details can be found on the Edit website, maritimeedit.com. I will see you next time.
Starter.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.